Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emmanuel in this important work, click on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Tonight we are looking at reason number 17. And reason number 17 is sort of an introduction to a lot of additional reasons. Reason number 17, he begins to attack the credibility of the New Testament directly. And so from here on out, we're going to be looking at some specific arguments about the text of the New Testament. And those will prove to be very interesting, I think. But there's a necessary evil to get over in the first place, and that's this one, number 17, which is this reason. The epistles and the gospels were not written by actual witnesses to the events they describe, which is kind of a curious reason. He goes on, here's a little bit of explanation. He says, first century epistles, the epistles being the epistles of Paul, the epistles of Peter, Timothy, or James, Jude, John. It says, the first century epistles do not describe an historical Jesus. Second century Gospels purport to witness historical events, but their putative authors, their so-called authors, would be a way to say that, could not have been alive in the second century when they were written. All right, we'll look at this claim and consider it and see if it has any merit. So he goes on, he says, first century epistles are not aware of Jesus' earthly history. This is a major premise that he's developing here. So when we say first century epistles, he's at least admitting that the epistles are authentic first century material. So the epistles are authentic first century material. But the problem with the epistles is that they never mention a written gospel. Now, of course, they mention the gospel of Jesus Christ, but that's in the general sense of the good news. They never mention the gospel of Matthew, the gospel of Mark, the gospel of Luke, the gospel of John. They never mention in any sense this idea of a document that is a gospel document, okay? So the epistles never mention a gospel, which strongly implies that the gospels did not exist. The epistles virtually never identify this Christ that they're talking about as a historical person. Instead, they speak of him in divine terms. And so he runs down a list here of points along these lines. He says, the epistles do not seem to even be aware of the human history of Jesus, the real human history of Yeshua. Their point of reference, they begin by speaking of Christ as the divine figure, the divine Christ, without reference to the human being, to the real historical person. They don't mention his sayings. They don't report his sayings, his parables, and that sort of thing, which would imply that the epistle writers don't know them. They don't know his sayings. They don't know his teachings. They don't know his parables. They never mention his miracles. They don't tell stories of his miracles. So there's not narrative episodes in them that says one time the master was, you know, walking along and he saw a blind man. And so you don't find that in the epistles. They do mention the Last Supper, but they don't place it in its historical context of Passover. They do refer to his death and resurrection, which is historical, but not as references to physical events on earth or in history. For example, they never mention the crucifixion at Calvary. They just never mention that it happened at Calvary. And they never mention the empty tomb or rising in Jerusalem, that this happened in a real location. and they seem to know nothing about Jesus' career on earth. Okay, so this is the argument. All right, this is the argument to say, what are we trying to prove here? We're trying to prove the late date of the Gospels. And we're trying to prove that the writers of the epistles have no first-hand knowledge of the historical Yeshua. So, we want Asher Norman wants us to accept that, first of all, the Gospels are 2nd century. They were written in the 2nd century, more than 100 years after the events that they purport to describe, so they can't possibly know what they're talking about. And secondly, that the writers of the epistles, Paul, mostly Paul, doesn't actually know anything about the historical Jesus or any of his teachings or anything like that. That's essentially what we're being offered here. If we look back over this list, though, beginning with point number one, I think each one of these premises is troubling and problematic to someone who really knows the epistles. To say that they begin with the divine Christ, well, Paul's, does it begin with the divine Christ? Is the divine Christ to the apostolic writers different than the historical person? Is that a different Christ? Are there two different Christs? No. And to say that Paul never, or the epistle writers never refer to the historical person is not true either, because there's, well, I mean, I didn't actually take the trouble to go and find a bunch of references, but I think you can take my word for it. There's plenty of references to the historical facts of the gospel and the historical person of Yeshua. However, it is an assumption in the epistles. All of that is assumed. All of that, it's assumed knowledge. And so the epistles are not under no obligation to rehearse the facts. They are, that's not their purpose. Anymore, what is an epistle? An epistle is a personal piece of communication. It's a personal letter. Let's say that you were writing an epistle. Let's say that you had a Christian friend who you were writing to about some concerns in their life or something like that. And you wanted to offer some consolation. You also saw that they were acting out of line in a few things, and you wanted to offer a little rebuke. Would you feel that you needed to first start off your epistle by running over the gospel again? Or in any case, do you need to establish the historicity of Jesus Christ and what it is that your shared and common faith is? You're writing to another believer in the first place. Okay, so that's a little troubling. Do not mention his sayings. Is this true? Do the epistles not mention his sayings? I would say there is a paucity, a lack of that in Paul's writings. It does appear that Paul is not, he doesn't have the oral material of the master just ready in his head. He quotes him a few times. The workman is worth his hire, he says. He gives us a saying of the master that's not in the Gospels, which is really nice because it's oral material for him. So he says, when he says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Well, that's not in the written Gospels, but it's a saying of Yeshua. It's an oral saying that Paul had. This is not surprising, though, in the Pauline epistles. Because in the Pauline epistle, what do we know about Paul? He was not a disciple. He didn't spend 3 years memorizing this man's words while he was with us. Instead, Paul came in, he says, as one born abnormally. And so, yes, Paul's writing from a different kind of vantage point, but he admits as much. Is it true regarding, say, James, that he doesn't quote the master? No. He rarely quotes him directly, but he does always quote, he brings his teachings and represents them. I have a very good commentary on James that shows how almost every one of James' teachings is a representation of a saying of the Master that he kind of builds off of, connecting it with other texts and that sort of thing. A very nice commentary.
You know what commentary that is?
Yeah. Let me see. Maybe I have it on this shelf right here. Yeah. Richard Bauckham. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent stuff. But that's just James. How about the Epistles of John? The Epistles of John seem to be soaked with the sayings of the Master. So that sometimes, like, you can't even tell when you hear it, is that from John? Is that from the Gospels? Or is that from the Epistles? So, it's not true that they don't mention his sayings. That they never mention his miracles. I can't think of an instance where the epistle writers do mention the miracles of the Master. I can't think of a particular miracle that they mention, so maybe that is true. They don't mention his miracles. Is that because the miracles are made up, or is it because they don't mention his miracles?
It doesn't apply to what they're writing.
Yeah, it doesn't apply to what they're writing, and the apostles are living out miracles. Do not place the Last Supper in a historical context. That's irrelevant. They reference the death and resurrection, but not as references to physical events on earth or in history. Not true. How would you make that claim that these are not references to the literal death and resurrection of Yeshua of Nazareth in Jerusalem in the year 30 Common Era? How do you get there? That somehow this is some sort of cosmic death and resurrection, or something like that, that has no connection to the real thing. So this is pretty weak, is what I'm saying. Never mentions a crucifixion at Calvary. And the only way he makes that work is by saying at Calvary. That particular word does not appear in the epistles. Of course, the epistles talk about the crucifixion quite a bit. Never mention empty tomb or rising in Jerusalem. That's not...
1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15.
If he didn't rise from the dead, then Paul even talked about that.
Yes. So that's not really fair. The point is that he's saying in Jerusalem. Does 1 Corinthians 15 have the word Jerusalem in it?
No.
I don't think so. And so that's his point.
Maybe they should have consulted him.
And they know nothing. It seems that they know nothing about Jesus' recent career on earth. And again, I would attribute that back to Paul. We're reading Paul's writings, and it's true that Paul was not a disciple. He's not reporting that. But again, that's not what he's attempting to do as he writes the epistles. He's not trying to relate that material. So I'm not impressed. I'm not impressed at all. In fact, I'm irritated, and it feels like a waste of time. On the other hand, it affords us an opportunity to talk about something that's of great interest to me, and that is the development of the New Testament. Because I think it's important. He does raise a good observation when he says, it looks like the epistle writers did not have a written gospel. Exactly. They didn't. They surely did not have a copy of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Let me go back. Let me start, rather than starting here in the New Testament, let me just kind of lay this out for you a little bit. Now, you look around at these books, you know, look at all those books. Like, that's a lot of books. And the Mishnah's over there, that's a lot of books. It looks like sages write a lot of books, doesn't it? But it wasn't like that in the days of the Master. In the days of the Master, Scripture was what you wrote. The Scriptures were written. And so teaching of Torah was oral. Because if you were to write down your teaching, it was a little presumptuous. What's written is written. What's oral is oral. And so you had a concept of written Torah and oral Torah. Now maybe this never occurred to you before, but have you never wondered that Jesus didn't just sit down and write a book?
They didn't have the printing press.
Well, yeah, but you could write a book. He could have sat down and wrote a book.
Someone knows anyway, right?
Yeah, he could have written something down. He could have just maybe a little...
You know, that wasn't the way the teachers of the day taught.
Right. That's not how they taught. That was not their deal. What they did was they raised disciples. And they raised these disciples, and then they taught them orally. And then the disciples' job was to memorize what the teacher said, and then to pass that on to their disciples when they became teachers. And this was called the oral tradition. Now, it came to pass that after the second Jewish revolt, and there was no longer a center of gravity, so to speak, to the Jewish world, so that you had the diaspora just spread out and no real solid authority, that the sages said, this ain't working anymore. We got to write this stuff down. And so Rabbi Judah the Prince wrote, this is in the early third century, Rabbi Judah the Prince finished a process that had been started in the previous generation by taking all these oral traditions of the rabbis and writing them down in a collection, a legal collection he called the Mishnah. Okay? Then the rest of the sages and rabbis of that generation got a copy of his Mishnah and he said, this is great. He wrote down all the oral teachings, the oral law. This is awesome. The oral law is written. But he left a lot of stuff out. And he got a lot of stuff wrong. And they began to argue about it. And their arguments were written down, and that's called the Talmud. And so now we've reached a stage where we have the oral law in written form. The Gospels follow this same pattern. The Gospels, also by a Tana, a teaching sage from the first century, are spoken. They're oral. His disciples memorize those words. It's not in their worldview to write a book, even, to write a gospel. Instead, they teach. They say, when the Master is with us, he always said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And they would pass on the sayings of the Master, and not just his sayings, but the stories and the miracles. And then there was the time that this happened. And then there was the time that this happened. And so you had all these little oral units. Scholars call them pericopes. These little oral units that would, were floating around the communities. Do you remember the time? It was in Cana. No, it wasn't. It was in Nazareth. It was in Cana, like that. And this was the body of lore that was the gospel in the days of the apostles. It was a living, breathing, collective community memory. There's a early second century Jewish believer by the name of Papias, who wrote a 5-volume collection of the oral sayings of the Master, the oral teachings of the Master that had not been recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it was a Midrash. Papias. Papias, perhaps. I like Papias.
Was he a disciple of John the Apostle?
Yes, he's a disciple of John, Papias. And he made it his job to, whenever the apostles, anyone who had been part of the original followers or the original community, he would get all the information he could from them, because he was writing this collection. Sadly, later generations of Christians found his collection useless, just bizarre. They found his collection just bizarre, and so we have only fragments from it that some of the church fathers wrote down, because they did not copy it and preserve it, because it was weird. Well, it was Jewish. It was thoroughly Jewish, and it read like the Midrash Rabbah. It was a totally different kind of literature than the church fathers were prepared to deal with. But anyway, I bring this up to demonstrate that there was this broad mass of oral teaching of the Master. And we see it surfacing here and there, here and there, here and there. It even comes into the Church Fathers. Church Fathers will say this, Yeshua used to teach this. And you're like, what? Where? When? You know, but they have, this was part of the community experience. They have the Gospel of Thomas. If you've ever seen the Gospel of Thomas, it's very interesting. The first inclination everybody wants to do is say, oh, that's just Gnostic rubbish, and throw it away. But it's just a little too close to the synoptics and to sayings in John to just throw it all away. But it's too far away to say that it was copied from those sources. Instead, what it betrays is that it's a collection of sayings that were passed, who knows, you know, how accurately, independently of the gospel traditions, into the hands of whoever wrote them down in Thomas. Really interesting stuff. I love that kind of stuff. Anyway, when did the gospels get written down as we have them? According to the church fathers, it starts with Matthew, who wrote in Hebrew. Matthew wrote in Hebrew, or perhaps Aramaic, because the church fathers called Aramaic Hebrew, so it's hard to know. But Matthew wrote in Aramaic, and we don't know what happened to that Matthew. Mark is the first writer in Greek, as far as we know. Mark wrote down the gospel in Greek for the Roman Christians, because the Roman believers, Mark was Peter's disciple, and so the Roman believers said, Peter was leaving them at some point, they said, please write this down for us so we know the sayings and the teachings of the Master. And Peter said, well, I couldn't write a book. And so he had Mark write for him. So Mark is the first gospel in Greek. Mark then becomes a source for two other writers. The writer of our Gospel of Matthew, which is not the same as the Hebrew Matthew, but our Gospel of Matthew and our Gospel of Luke both have a copy of Mark that they're copying from as they write their Gospels. But Matthew and Luke also have another source that they call Q. Yeah, no, we call Q. They didn't call it Q. They called it the other source we have, the other Gospel we have. So, what you'll find is that Matthew and Luke have material Mark doesn't have. But if Mark has material, Matthew and Luke have it, generally. Matthew and Luke copy from Mark, so they will agree on what they get from Mark. And then Matthew and Luke will agree on what they get from Q, but Mark won't have that. How's that? Okay. So Q is lost, except for what we could put together and say, well, both Matthew and Luke have this, but Mark doesn't. Then Matthew, of course, has his own material that he's picked up from the community. And Luke really goes to town, as he says in the beginning of his gospel. He says, a lot of people have tried to put together some sort of narrative, some sort of record. So I went and investigated everything thoroughly, and this is what you've got. And so Luke goes and gets a lot of material from, Luke has a long time in the Jerusalem community while Paul is sitting in prison in Caesarea for 2 years. Luke has 2 years in the Jerusalem and Caesarea community to knob around with the original apostles and get material from them. So we find that Luke has things that neither Matthew nor Mark have. But you see the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right? That's why they're called synoptic gospels, because they're so closely tied together. Then, John is a completely different animal. John is written in Ephesus. And according to church tradition, John is written by the Apostle John. But I would like to disagree with that, if you'll entertain me for a moment on that theory. I believe John was written by the disciples of John in Ephesus. So John probably compiled by his Jewish and Gentile disciples in the city of Ephesus after John's death. How do we know? Because at the end of John, it says This is the disciple who saw these things and wrote these things. We know that his testimony is true, and it goes into this first person plural voice talking about how John is dead now, and he's and what he said is true. So there's your final redactor anyway. Your final hand in the Gospel of John is posthumous, meaning after John's death. Pardon me?
Similarly, Revelation.
Revelation is different. Most scholars do not believe that Revelation is written by the same John. They think it's written by a different guy named John, which is possible. There was a lot of guys named John. I like to think that it's the same John. Church tradition is really strong that it's the same John.
And so when you're saying the same John, you're saying that group of John's disciples? No. John. Okay.
According to church legend, when John left for Ephesus, he was assigned to go there by the 12. They took a map and they said, "Hey, you know, the master told us to go and we haven't gone, we better go." And so this is like 11 years after or something. And so they cast lots and John got Asia Minor, where Paul had been working. So he gets to go clean up his mess. And so he's sent to Ephesus. And he says, "I can't go to it. I don't speak Greek." And so they say, "Well, take Prochorus with you." Prochorus is one of the seven deacons. So Prochorus goes with John to Ephesus as his translator. And then John lives in Ephesus and he travels and he goes around to the communities in Asia Minor and he's probably learning Greek while he's doing this. But so Prochorus would be the writer. Just like Paul always had a writer, John would have a writer and a translator. And so that strong Johannine voice that we recognize would probably be the voice of his translator. Whereas the very bad Greek of Revelation, which is thoroughly Semitic, and I don't read Greek, so don't think of me as I'm just telling you what I've read about it. It's bad Greek, the syntax is bad, and it's a very Semitic form of Greek. That may be John's hand as near the end of his life, because he receives a command from heaven that says, write. All right, when did these things happen? Most New Testament scholars would place the Synoptic Gospels late in the first century, like in the 70s, 80s, 90s. All right? And that's possible. And they would place John in the beginning of the second century. I would move those back a little bit. I would say that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are pre-destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Because they don't mention it. And it would be, if you were writing that after the destruction of Jerusalem, when you got to those apocalyptic narratives where the master was telling what was going to happen and how it was going to go down, you'd sort that out. And you wouldn't be able to resist saying, "And this came to pass exactly as he had said." So, yeah, I would argue that they're pre-70. And that stands to reason. If the story about Mark is true, Mark would have to be written before Peter died, and Peter died in 65, I think. Oh, they argue about it. They would say, in regard to that point, they would say, no, this is it's actually an attempt to make it look prophetic. To which I would reply again, if you were going to do that, you'd do a lot better job. They're critical scholars. So, I mean, it's just critical scholars start from the assumption of zero, that it's not true. And so that's something that people oftentimes don't understand when they read critical scholarship, is that critical scholarship has a bias. It's not unbiased. It intentionally has a bias, and the bias is to overcompensate on the side of criticism. That's why it's called criticism. And by overcompensating with criticism, hopefully you're able to cut through a lot of assumptions. This is not just the approach to the Bible. Critical scholarship, that's how it works across the board. We would do the same thing to Greek literature, We'd do the same thing to something that's allegedly written by Plato. We'll do the same thing to something that's allegedly written by Homer. That's Shakespeare. It's a methodology. But people don't understand that. And so they take the conclusions of critical scholarship, which should be understood to be way, like, this is as low as you can go. And they understand that as like, oh, well, that's what it is then. They're not faith-based. They're not people of faith whatsoever. And unfortunately, a lot of what passes for critical scholarship, for good critical scholarship, is not good critical scholarship. Unfortunately, the field is just as full of goofballs as any other field. You know, I mean, you know, every one of you who has a career knows that there's people in your career field who are legitimate and people who are goofballs. And the average person can't tell the difference. But you can, because you're in the field. Well, it's the same in biblical criticism. I would not say that, I would not go that far to say they have no basis in fact, because a critical scholar will present you with his evidence as you read. He'll say, this is why I think this, and this is what I see. You know, this is, I see this here, and that indicates such and such. But then some other scholar will come along and say, you're wrong about that. This is where you made a mistake. You know, so it's like an ongoing dialogue that never ends. That's an excellent example. He's referring to Chaim Mokobi's book. That's an excellent example of junk scholarship, is what it's called in the academic community. Junk scholarship in the cloak of critical scholarship. So it pretends to be, you know, this legitimate stuff, but it's really just wild-eyed theories. Enough of that. What about John? So I'm, you know, and you don't have to take my word for it. You can say whenever you want, as long as you keep the synoptics in the first century. But, well, some scholars would put them in the early second century, but here's one verse that I would go with for a post-destruction. There's a passage in John where he's describing Gethsemane, and he says, there used to be a garden there, and there's not anymore. You know, the implication being the garden is gone. Well, we know that the Romans denuded Mount of Olives in building siege works and crosses to crucify Jews on during the siege. So John says there used to be a garden there. So I would take that as perhaps an indication that it's after the destruction of Jerusalem. There's other clues in John that tell us that it's late. There's the antipathy, the strong
I don't like you
feelings between the Johannine community and the Jewish community. That comes through very clearly in John. So that tells you that there's enough time has passed where there's an identity that has formed that's separate, that now sees itself as separate from greater Judaism around it. And so if we look at the historical data, what could have caused that? Well, for one thing, around the year 90, Common Era, believers were thrown out of the synagogue. And we have the introduction of the blessing against heretics. And so we know that under the Sanhedrin at Yavne of Rabbi Gamliel ben Shimon. I always get those mixed up. Under Gamliel ben Shimon, that the believers are excommunicated. The reason you find that kind of polemical edge all the time in John. But the Jews said this, and the Jews did that. And you don't find that in the Synoptics. In the Synoptics, we're all Jews still. You know, in John, it's like the Jews versus us. So that's another indication that John is late. So how late? We don't really know. But I would guess no earlier than 90, Common Era. John died around the end of the first century, somewhere between, he lived into Trajan's time, it says in the Church Fathers, and so that would have him dying in the last decade of the first century. He was really old. He was 100 years old, or something like that. Those are the Gospels, and that's why when we read the epistles, it doesn't seem like they are reading the Gospels. Because the Gospels aren't written yet. Good enough. Okay, second century Gospels do not present a credible picture. When he says second century Gospels, he means all of them, because he's going with the most liberal of the critical scholarship, which places them all in the second century. All right? So he says, here's the problem. Even if you take these Gospels, you've got John over here, and you've got the Synoptics over here, and the Synoptics kind of agree on stuff, but then there's discrepancies with John. For example, he gives us the Passover discrepancy. What's the Passover discrepancy? Oy. It's a real problem. John gives us a chronology of the Passion Week according to one, this day one, day two, day three sort of thing, and the Synoptics give us a totally different. So in John, the Last Supper actually happens the day before Passover. So it's not a Passover Seder per se. Whereas in the Synoptics, it's the day of Passover had come. And so it's definitely a Passover Seder. So you have, that's probably the biggest discrepancy chronologically. But there's a couple others between John and the Gospels. There's various ways to reconcile these. We could do that. We could create a couple pages of Gemara and argue about it and come up with a couple different theories. And I've done that now and then at different points. But I'm happiest when I just say, this is a difficulty. This is, because I don't like to rob the credibility of John, and I don't like to rob the credibility of the Synoptics. I like to preserve them both and admit, yes, this is a difficulty. Rabbi Lichtenstein has a nice reconciliation. I can't remember it. He does a nice reconciliation. Everybody does. Everybody takes a swing at it. You know? Okay. So he says, and here's another one. In the Synoptics, everybody agrees how the disciples are called. Jesus walking along the beaches of Capernaum. He says, Peter, come follow me. John, come follow me. They leave their nets. They come follow him. John tells a totally different story. In John, it's two disciples of John the Baptist, Andrew, and an unidentified disciple follow Jesus. Andrew goes and gets Peter. It's a totally different story. Then they go and they turn water to wine. Then they go up to Passover together. You know, and all of this and happens, right? It's a totally different story, completely different. It really is. So how do you what do you do with that? Well, they're not actually competing narratives. They're only competing if you assume that the first time that when Yeshua walked up to Peter and he said, come follow me, Peter had never seen this guy in his life before, didn't know who he was, and dropped his nets and followed him in a zombie-like trance. You know, and I think that's the way that we generally think of it, but that's definitely not the story. John tells us the story that happened before the arrest of John the Baptist. The Synoptic Gospels begin their narratives with the disciples after the arrest of John the Baptist. And that's the difference. John gives us the backstory of how he knew these guys in the first place and why it was that they were willing to give up everything and follow him in the first place. The prequel. Yeah. All right, what else does he say? Mark is the source for Luke and Matthew. Right. We've already covered that. John has no infancy narratives. That's true. Neither does Mark, by the way. So.
What does that mean?
Nothing. So he says, most New Testament scholars believe the Gospels existed in some form in the late first century. Wow! Did you see that? That's what he said. Most New Testament scholars believe the Gospels existed in some form in the late first century. However, he says, this seems highly unlikely since the epistles never refer to them. Conclusion, unknown individuals who were not disciples, apostles, or witnesses to the events described wrote the Gospels. There you go. All right. The Christian Bible has been altered and corrected. Okay, now we move into another field of attack. Let's say that we have the whole thing. We have the New Testament, and it's all in these Greek documents, and we've got one copy. All right, we've got one copy, and so now we want to start disseminating it. It never happened so cleanly as this, of course. Instead, I mean, let's be reasonable. At what point did someone say, well, here it is, I just finished the New Testament. Let's start copying this and sending this out to the churches. How did this happen for real? Have you ever thought about this? How did we get this New Testament? The actual, like, what books are legitimate wasn't determined for several hundred years. What you had was every church in every place, every community of believers had their precious books. They had their scrolls and their precious books. And they would copy these and send them to buddies and to exchange them. They would borrow them. They'd be, oh, we promise we'll bring it back to you, you know, right after Passover. You know, and then they would read them aloud. They would read them aloud when they would assemble, because 99% of the people were not literate. So the person who, like, you had someone in your congregation who could read, that was great. And so the reader would read, and he would read them aloud. Everybody listens. And then you pass these around. And eventually, the church, as it develops ecclesiastical authority, it says, you know, some places are reading some really weird stuff. There is some really, really wacko weird stuff being read out there, and it's causing problems. We need to figure out what goes back to the first generation. And so what they did was they looked at the consensus of writers, ancient writers, early writers, and what they cited as the epistles and gospels that they had that were the authentic apostolic voice. So to be authentic and to make the final cut, you had to, number one, be part of the apostolic community. You were either an apostle or a disciple of an apostle. All right? And number two, it had to be part of that first century era, which I guess is the same as number one in terms of human lifespan. Yes?
I was reading about that just this week.
Okay.
One of my questions was, the people that were making this decision here, mm-hmm. based on these writings back here, could they have had a bias about what it was that they were accepting based on
yes.
where they thought that they
yes.
were coming from?
Yes, and that's often brought up, is that they did have a bias, and they threw out things that should not have been thrown out. But the thing is, we have most of what they threw out. It's still extant, most of it. Unfortunately, the ones that are not still extant are the Jewish Gospels. Those we only have in fragments, the ones from Hebrew and that sort of thing. That would be what would be nice to have. But in terms of the Greek texts, you don't want any of that. The stuff they threw out, they made good decisions. They made very good decisions. And how do we know? How can you tell? Just read it. You read it, you'll say, that was a good thing to throw that out. It's so not Jewish. The stuff they threw out is so not Jewish that it smells. You know, it smells phony. As you're reading it, you there's no question, this is phony. If you're familiar with the authentic, if you know a good cigar, you know when you've got a bad one. You know? I'm talking about Gnosticism. I'm talking about the Gnostic Gospels. And not only the Gnostic stuff, there's different stuff that's kind of just is strange. I enjoy that material. And I enjoy reading it and trying to figure out who thought of this and what were they trying to accomplish and that sort of thing. But it's not just that. There's also what you could call Orthodox Christians that are fabricating material, like fabricating Pauline letters and that sort of thing in order to advance their agendas. Or because they're just like, they'd like more of the story, you know. It's like, well, they want a sequel, you know. So you do see a lot of that. You see all those apocryphal Acts of the Apostles, where the apostles are doing all sorts of tremendous miracles. It's entertainment. It was first or second, third century entertainment. The reason that a New Testament was canonized was because of Martian. Who's Martian? Everybody know Martian? Martian Martian's last name is the Heretic. And I can tell you his story really quickly. It's an interesting story. He comes to Rome in the mid-second century, and he wants to be a bishop. And they say, you can't be a bishop, because he's got all sorts of wacko ideas. But here's the thing. He's rich. And so he has a lot of money. And so he makes a big, big donation to the Roman bishops. And so they say, okay. And so then he starts to bring his teaching there that he's been teaching in other places. And what he's done is, Martian has, he's one of the first real successful Gnostics. And what what that means is, he's decided that the God of the Old Testament is evil, and a deceiver, and Jesus is the real deal, and he's the one who unseats the God of the Old Testament. Not that Jesus is God, rather Jesus is a emanation of an completely unknowable God that's far higher than the God of the Old Testament. So that makes all of Judaism and all of the Torah bad. Mm-hmm. And it makes it, so the worst thing you can do is be Torah observant. So then Martian says you shouldn't be reading that, and he takes all that Old Testament stuff out. Then he says, and most of this is junk too. So he takes out Matthew, Mark, John. He gets rid of Acts. He gets rid of most of the epistles. In fact, he just keeps a few of Paul's epistles, and he edits them heavily. And as for a gospel, he keeps Luke, and he edits it heavily and takes out all the Jewish parts. That's what he calls them, the Jewish parts. So then he's teaching this Judaism-free form of Christianity. Sound familiar? Yeah, so he's teaching this Judaism-free form of Christianity. The bishops of Rome find out what he's doing, and they say, here's your money back, get out of town. And they exile him and throw him out of town and give him the last name of the Heretic. But the thing with Martian is that he was very successful, and his teachings were very popular, and they persisted long after him in many different forms of Gnosticism. So that the church fathers through the 2nd century and 3rd century pretty much are just full-time busy refuting Gnostics. That's kind of all they do, is refute Gnostics. And so that shows you the size of footprint he left on developing Christianity. So yes, the church fathers said, this guy is, not only has he torn up the Bible, but then other Gnostics are introducing all sorts of secret gospels, gospel of Mary Magdalene, mm-hmm. gospel of James, gospel, you know, all these that you hear about that are popular again, gospel of Judas. So they said, that's when they said, we need to declare what's canonical, so to speak. I don't know if they even use that term, but what's authentic. That's what they were trying to do. What is the authentic apostolic voice? And that's where the New Testament comes from. So they gather in from the churches, what are you reading? What do we have? And they sift through it, and over the process of a long time, they come down to, this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good. We're not sure about this, we're not sure about this, we're not sure about this. Some stuff got cut that probably shouldn't have. Like what?
Didache.
Clement. Didache. Mm-hmm. Yep. Some stuff almost got cut. Papias. Papias, yeah. Papias should have been, at least he should have had some input into the process. Papias should not have been cut. Some stuff almost got cut. Revelation almost got cut. Because it's so Jewish. 1,000-year millennium, that's Jewish teaching. A literal reign of Messiah on earth, that's Jewish teaching. So that was really dangerous. We almost lost Revelation. Hebrews was almost cut. Now Hebrews, the issue with Hebrews, very Jewish, but the real issue was we didn't know who the author is.
Yeah.
Unknown authorship. James, almost cut. Why was James almost cut? There's never a good answer. The real answer is because they saw him as conflicting with Paul, I think. 1st and 2nd Peter were uncertain as well. I don't know what else.
2nd and 3rd John.
2nd and 3rd John. Okay.
There were 7 of them.
Could have lost more. Maybe we did lose more that we don't know about. I don't know. You know, it's better safe than sorry with this stuff, I guess. That's what they were thinking. So they were, and that's something that you should realize, is they were very conservative in what they would declare as apostolic. Very conservative. So all these documents now, you've got multiple versions of these manuscripts. At this point, you didn't start with one set of manuscripts. You've got multiple versions of manuscripts that have, and now you need to somehow get to the point where you decide which set is authoritative. And that's why we have, you know, we joke about it, but there are more textual variants in the New Testament than there are actual words in the New Testament. That's true. That's true. But that's why. Now, if we were the Jewish community with Masoretes, here's what we do. We'd make a decision on which set we're going to use, destroy the rest, and declare everyone who used any of the others a heretic. And then we would come down and we'd be able to say, see, every single letter is exactly as God dictated it to Moshe or Paul, and say, it's all just the way, you know, because that is the way that the Jewish community looks at the Tanakh and understands the Torah. But it's not true. And the Samaritan Torah will prove it. A lot of our textual variants circle around those critical passages too, during the deity wars. Is he God? Is he not God? And so you see a lot of times the textual variants will be circling around passages like I always like, one of my favorites is in the beginning of the Gospel of John, where it says, of the only begotten God, or is it the only begotten Son? In one version, it's the only begotten God, and in the other, it's the only begotten Son. So let's push on through this now, because I think we've achieved a sufficiently mature view of the origin of our New Testament at this point. Okay? It didn't just, thank you, God! Because that's kind of the way that, you know, a lot of our faith looks at it. Unfortunately, what happens then is if inerrancy, every infallibility, inerrancy, every jot and tittle type of approach, it doesn't hold up to reality and people lose their faith over it. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're trying to defend people's faith by feeding them, you know, just saying, you know, close your eyes, stuff your ears, don't listen to that. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You know, and it's really not going to work in the information age. When I can go on Google and in 10 seconds have like more textual criticism on the New Testament, I mean, any 15-year-old kid can do this, you know? We've got to deal in reality if we're to survive as a faith. Okay, so the Christian Bible has been altered. Who says? Chalcis says it. Christians altered the original text 3 or 4 times or even more with the intention of thus being able to destroy the arguments of their critics. He's right. In, you know, we're talking about those circular texts. It's particularly the is Jesus God, is Jesus not God, those sorts. So we have the textual variants to prove that there is altering going on between this manuscript and that manuscript. But who is Chalcis anyway? He's a pagan. Chalcis is a pagan who hated Christians. And so he wrote satirical, scathing, anti-Christian material in the 2nd century. Origen, what does he say? 3rd century, he says, it's an obvious fact today that there is much diversity among the manuscripts, due either to the carelessness of scribes, the perverse audacity of some people in correcting the text, or again to the fact that there are those who add or delete as they please, setting themselves up as correctors. Yes, that's correct. But understand what Origen is saying. Origen is not saying, therefore we can't trust our New Testaments. Origen is saying, that's why there are so many discrepancies between the New Testament manuscripts that we have. He's not saying, well, we don't know if this is even authentic or if this can even be trusted. That's not his point whatsoever. He's explaining why in one text it might say Son, in another it might say God. All right. Pious frauds and fabulous wonders. Asher Norman goes on to quote another scholar talking about the introduction of all the Gnostic Gospels and that sort of thing, and he uses that as if it's evidence against the authentic Gospels. Not written by Jesus' apostles. It is certain that the New Testament was not written by Jesus himself, nor by his apostles, but a long while after them by some unknown persons as forgeries. And this guy is the Reverend Robert Taylor. And if he says it, I mean, he says it is certain. He says it right there. It is certain that the New Testament was not written by Jesus, well, we knew that, nor by his apostles, but a long while after them by some unknown persons. Okay. Reverend Robert Taylor says that. You know what else Reverend Robert Taylor says? I thought I'd just find out on Google. Reverend Robert Taylor was a radical from the 1890s. He was an anti-church radical. So he was most famous as the devil's chaplain in England. He was called the devil's chaplain. He would wear these liturgical robes, like way over the top liturgical robes, and do these sermons. So one of his sermons was God and the devil, that they are but one and the self-same being. Hell and hellfire are in the original nothing more than names and titles of the supreme God. This was one of his premises, that God is the devil and the devil is God. So not really a credible source to be quoting, but at least someone that Asher Norman could find that agreed with him. Which version is authoritative? Now this time he's bringing in Josh McDowell. You've heard of Josh McDowell. And he's quoting from Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Josh McDowell is quoting from Philip Schaff in his book, Comparison of the Greek Testament and the English Version. And he says, although he was dealing with fewer manuscripts than we have today, Philip Schaff concluded that only 400 of the 150,000 text variant readings caused doubt about the textual meaning. And only 50 of these were of great significance. And so Asher Norman says, those are supposed to be good numbers? You mean there's 400? You have 400 textual variants that cause doubt about what it's supposed to say? And only 50 of them are really important? That doesn't sound like good numbers. But really, you'd have to look at them. I mean, you really have to look at them to see. 50 of them that are important are the type we're saying, you know, the only begotten Son, the only begotten God. There's probably 50 that would make some sort of difference, in other words. There's some 400 of them where we're not exactly sure where to put the semicolon or the period. You know, where you're not exactly sure how the sentence was supposed to end or something like that, or where the next one was going to begin. You know, of that they make a difference for your reading and your translation. That's why if you compare different Bible versions, oftentimes, you know, you'll have, you know, differences in the text, depending on which manuscript family they're translating from. But these numbers actually aren't that bad. Yeah, I know it sounds bad. 400? 50? Asher Norman says, think of it this way. Suppose this was a medical textbook. And you had 400 different versions of the medical textbook that the doctors were learning from. But it's not a medical textbook. It's not. No one said it was. That would be weird if a publisher printed a medical textbook and have 400 textual variants between the different copies. It was really, that would be weird. But it's not weird for a document that has been assembled the way that the New Testament was assembled. It's not weird at all.
If you were going to be fair about it, then you would say, if medicine had not advanced, and you take all of the different medical books from the same time and put them together, that would be a more fair statement.
Yeah.
If you're coming from the premise that you have to have your doctrine right for salvation, then it becomes more of an issue.
And I think those were, maybe there's 50 instances where you could lose your salvation over a textual variant. I don't know about that. One of the funniest to me is the number of the beast. You know, 666. But there's a textual variant that says it's 668. And so you go, oh! I'm going to be damned if I accept the 666, but the 668 is okay. Then you find out that, no, it was 668, or vice versa. Could be a real problem. So Asher Norman says, is this divine communication? And that's a very good question. Is this divine communication? Maybe this is a better question. What do you mean by divine communication? What are you looking for by divine communication? Are you looking for God to dictate, maybe to a secretary who's listening on a dictaphone or something like that? Is that what we were expecting? Is that what we were anticipating? Or are we looking for God to move in the lives of human beings who were inspired of the Holy Spirit and they wrote things? Because that's what you got. All you have is the work of human hands. That's what the Bible is. As the apostles say, human beings who wrote under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. What does inspiration mean? It's like breath. It's like the breath of the Holy Spirit. All right, it's real. So the Bible's real. Important thing to learn. In sharp contrast to the Christian Bible, there are no versions of the Torah, Asher Norman says. There's no textual variants. There's only one Torah. Every letter, he goes into great detail about this, you know, how every letter, every scribe, every jot, every tittle, 100% the way that God dictated it to Moses, which of course is an Orthodox Jewish perspective. It's just not reality. That is no more reality than a fundamentalist Baptist saying to you, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. There's only one word of God. It's all, you know, and has never looked further than that. And has never taken even a simple class on the origin of the New Testament. It's not true regarding the Torah. It's not true regarding the Tanakh. The Dead Sea Scrolls alone prove that there's many versions. We've talked about this already in this class. Rabbi Meir's Torah scroll? Remember they're talking about Rabbi Meir's Torah scroll has all these variant readings and they're all upset about it? Yeah. Yeah, Samaritan Pentateuch has in some cases better readings than the Masoretic text, that when you see the Samaritan reading on it, you go, oh, yeah, that makes a lot more sense, exactly. Here's the conclusion. It is not possible to determine the true authors of the Christian Bible. I disagree. The disciples and apostles could not have been the authors because they were not alive when the text was written in the second century. The text wasn't written in the second century. There are thousands of versions of the Christian Bible. That's true. There are thousands of manuscripts. There literally are thousands of manuscripts. And there's strength in that, that there's been no editor. There's been no Masoretes. There's no hand that's corrected this. There's no conspiracy. There's thousands of independent witnesses, manuscripts from communities all over, and they testify to a unity of the text more so than to a disparity of the text. Yes, there's a lot of punctuation, spelling, you know, all sorts of differences. Sometimes whole chunks of the gospel narrative show up in a different spot in the gospel. You know, like a chapter is rearranged or something like that, or a chapter is moved. Sometimes, you know, big differences like that. But the story is the same. So there are thousands of versions of the Christian Bible? Yes. The writers and translators continually altered and corrected the text using perverse audacity in making changes. Well, to some extent, that's true. A little bit, here and there, and we can see it. And that's the advantage to having thousands of manuscripts. Because then you can check it, and you can say, it says it there, but does it say it here? And so there's like a check and balance. You don't have that with the Tanakh anymore. You don't have a system of checks and balances. Whatever the scribes say, it says, that's what it says now. 400 of these versions create doubt as to textual meaning. Of these, 50 are of great significance. Okay. The credibility of the Torah is unimpeachable. Not true. The credibility of the Torah is highly impeachable by these standards. Sorry to say. Brings me no joy to say. All right, that's it for tonight.